మాధవ కుంజ విహారీ జయ గోపీ జనవల్లభ గిరివర ధారీ జనవల్లభ గిరివర ధారీ జశోర నందన బ్రజ జనరంజన శోదనందన బ్రజ జనరంజన జామున తీరావనచారీ జామున తీరావనచారీ
Vishnupad Paramahamsa Privirajakacharya Shatrashat Shishimad, His Divine Grace, Shri A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki, Anant Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki, Samvet Bhakta Vrinda Ki, Gaur Premanande. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Hare Krishna. So today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th canto, 11th chapter. We'll read the 6th and 7th verses. Please repeat after me. Dukham sukham vyatiriktam chativram. Kalo papanam phalam avyanakti. Alingya maya rachitantaratma. Swadehinam samshriti chakrakutah. Dukham sukham vyatiriktam chativram. Kalo papanam phalam avyanakti. Alingya maya rachitantaratma. Swadehinam samshriti chak. Dukham sukham vyatiriktam chativram. कालोपपन्नं फलं आव्यनक्ति आलिंग्य माया रचितांतरात्मा स्वदेहिनां संश्रुति चक्रकूटः
Now, whoever would like to can chant. Maybe we'll alternate between men and women.
Dukham sukham va.
Sukham vyatiriktam cha tivram Sukham vyatiriktachivam Sukham vyatiriktam cha tivram kalopapannam phalam avyanakti alingya maya rachitantaratma svadehinam samshriti chakrakutah.
So in the interest of time, we won't do the word for word. This is a translation. I'll read the translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. The materialistic mind, covering the living entity's soul, carries it to different species of life. This is called continued material existence. Due to the mind, the living entity suffers or enjoys material distress and happiness. Being thus illusioned, the mind further creates pious and impious activities and their karma, and thus the soul becomes conditioned. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Mental activities under the influence of material nature cause happiness and distress within the material world. Being covered by illusion, the living entity eternally continues conditioned life under different designations. Such living entities are known as Nitya Badha, eternally conditioned. On the whole, the mind is the cause of conditioned life. Therefore, the entire yogic process is meant to control the mind and the senses. It's a powerful sentence. I want to read that again. On the whole, the mind is the cause of conditioned life. Therefore, the entire yogic process, is meant to control the mind and the senses. If the mind is controlled, the senses are automatically controlled, and therefore the soul is saved from the reactions of pious and impious activity. If the mind is engaged at the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, the senses are automatically engaged in the Lord's service. When the mind and senses are engaged in devotional service, the living entity naturally becomes Krishna conscious. As soon as one always thinks of Krishna, he becomes a perfect yogi, as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, yoginam api sarvesham madgaten anantaratmanaha. This anantara atma, the mind, is conditioned by material nature. As stated here, maya rachitantaratma svadehinam samshriti chakra kutaha. The mind, being most powerful, covers the living entity and puts him or her in the waves of material existence. So I'll also read the verse for text 7, although we'll focus on text 6. Translation. The mind makes the living entity within the material world wander through different species of life, and thus the living entity experiences mundane affairs in different forms as a human being, as a demigod, as a fat person, as a skinny person, and so forth. Learned scholars say that bodily appearance, bondage, and liberation are caused by the mind.
Tamrandasya Giranjana Shalakaya Chakshur and Militam Gena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Namashestam Manumapi Sachiputra Matara Surupam Rupam Tasya Graja Urupurim Maturim Goshtavatim Radha Kundam Girivaramo Radhika Madhavasam Praptoyasya Pratita Kripaya Shri Guru Namnatosmi.
I offer my loving and grateful obeisances unto the beautiful lotus-like feet of my spiritual master, by whose grace I have been introduced to the holy name, to the sacred mantra, to the son of Sachi Mata, Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I have been introduced to such illustrious personalities as Swarup Damodar, Rupa Goswami, and his elder brother, Sanatan Goswami. By the grace of my Guru, I have been given access to the holy place of Mathura and to the innermost secrets of Vrindavan. By the mercy of my spiritual master, I am allowed to sit at the feet of Sri Govardhan Hill. And I am engaged in the worship of their lordships, Sri Sri Radha Vrindavan Bihari, or Sri Sri Radha Madhava. To such a spiritual master, I offer my humble obeisances. Hare Krishna. If everyone wouldn't mind, if everyone could come forward a little bit, if you're able to. It's a little difficult, and the rains may start at any moment, so it's difficult to hear and to see the screen, maybe. So before we dive into the theme, okay, that's good. This Vyasa-san is big, but it's not that big. So before we dive into the discussion, and I want to focus specifically on that one part of the purport where Srila Prabhupada is stressing that the entire yogic process is just about somehow or other, I'm paraphrasing, but somehow or other, controlling the mind. If we can control the mind, then everything follows from that. So I'd like to explore this. But before we do that, I want to take a poll. Does everyone notice the bats that swoop in and out of the temple room? Yeah? Some of you maybe took a day or two to notice if you're visiting. So please raise your hand if you like the bats that swoop in and out of the temple room. Be honest. Raise your hand. Including residents of Govardhan Eco Village. You can also vote. No. Please raise your hand if you don't like the bats that swoop in and out of the temple room. Okay. So, a number of years ago, I brought a group of university students to the Eco Village. And our first day here, everyone came to the temple. And everyone's having a really nice experience. And there was one particular student. She was a second-year student, African-American girl, who had never been out of the country. She'd never been out of the States. So this was her, not only her first time in India, not only her first time at the Eco Village, but her first time anywhere outside of America. And she just like loved being in the temple room. And she was talking about how peaceful it is, how wonderful the environment, the atmosphere. And she said, it's so nice. And even these birds would come swooping in to the temple room. It was so nice. And I just, without even thinking, I just said, oh, you mean the bats? Those are bats, actually. For the rest of the trip, she was deathly afraid to even come inside the temple room. So I just want you to think about that for a moment. Okay, second story. Sorry. A number of years ago, our daughter, Shruti Sara, was on the soccer team. And my wife and I, Krishangi and I, we would attend her games and her practices. And one day there was a game, and we were sitting with all the other parents. How many of you play soccer? How many of you have kids who play soccer or football here? Okay. Wow, we have to talk later. There's so much I don't know about you. So you know sometimes they have the game, and then some distance away, there's like they set up like these kind of folding chairs or lawn chairs, and all the parents are sitting there, and the parents are cheering the kids on. So we were sitting there at a distance, and we're cheering Shruti, Sara, and her teammates on. And you know, these are long games, so you get a little distracted. So we just started to have a side conversation. So we turned from the field for a second, we started to have a side conversation. And when we turned back, we looked at the field and we noticed that Shruti had gotten possession of the ball. And we could see, it was a little far, but we could see. And she was just driving the ball and just expertly weaving in and out, and just she was carrying that ball forward, and we just started cheering for her. And she was getting closer and closer to the goal, and they were trying to defend. She was just making all these moves, and she was just going to take it straight to the goal. And we were cheering more and more. The excitement was building up. We were getting louder and louder. And inside me, my own level of excitement was starting to rise and rise and rise. And I was thinking, all these years, like when I was a kid, I was so terrible at sports. I'm still terrible at sports. And all these years, I was tormented by, as we say in America, the jocks. You know who the jocks are? The jocks are these people, they're ahankar, their whole material designation, their upadhi, is that of being an athlete. And usually they rule the school, at least when I went to school, they ruled the school. And if you weren't good at athletics, these guys could make your life pretty miserable. So I was thinking, you know, I had to suffer so much, but it will all be vindicated. Just like Dhritarashtra was thinking, Duryodhan will sit on the throne that I couldn't sit on. So I was thinking, Shruti Sara will take the revenge. She's going to become a star athlete. And then I was thinking, you know, this is great. Maybe she'll start going to soccer camp. And maybe she'll get, you know, a soccer scholarship. Maybe she'll go pro, I don't know, you know, that's her choice. But so I was thinking all this, and then she scores the goal, and it's like amazing. Oh my gosh, this is the most amazing thing. And I happen to look over at the bench, and there's Shruti Sara drinking water, talking to her teammate. See, what had happened was I didn't realize, but somehow or other, this team, for reasons I still don't understand, there were two kids with the same number on their jersey. And so this whole time, I was seeing this kid, let's say number 21, that was Shruti's number, but it was the other number 21. So I was cheering on the wrong kid. I was getting excited about the wrong kid. And as soon as I realized it, what happened to all those, that excitement, that enthusiasm, all that, those big plans, those dreams, what happened? Pff, they all came crumbling down. Not crumbling down, I still... But those particular dreams didn't necessarily get fulfilled. Okay, final story, and then we're gonna dive in. Final story just happened a couple of days ago, so fresh in my memory. How many of you have an umbrella? How many of you have at least once in the last X number of days here have misplaced or lost your umbrella? Now be honest, how many of you have taken someone else's umbrella? Same number of hands that lost also took, right? So the other day, we were in Satsang Bhavan, and I put my umbrella where I usually put it, and it was raining. Started to leave. I went to get the umbrella. Umbrella's gone. And just walking from Satsang Bhavan, I saw one Mataji, and she had my umbrella. The rain is coming down, and I see her with my umbrella. So I don't know what to do. Should I call out to her, Mataji? No, 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 that's my umbrella. But then, I don't know. So I started walking in the rain. And it just so happened she was walking in the same direction. So I was walking. She was walking just a few feet in front of me with my umbrella, staying dry. And I was walking behind her with no umbrella, getting wet. And it started out, I was just observing, okay, she has my umbrella, I'm getting wet, this doesn't feel good, she looks nice and dry. And then what started happening was this anger started arising in me. It's not fair. What a thoughtless thing to do. What a selfish thing to do. It's obviously my umbrella. I kept it in a very specific place. I kept it right near my chappals. That's my system. Foolproof system. She must have known. She must have not had an umbrella. But selfishly, she took the umbrella. She doesn't care what happens to me. She doesn't care what happens to anyone else. As long as she and her precious sari stay dry, everyone else can go to hell. I started thinking, what kind of people come to this Govardhan Eco Village? These day visitors, they come in and they try to... I'm staying here for so many days. Okay? I'm practically a resident here. And this Mataji, she has the audacity to steal umbrellas. Does she know who I am? All the way to wherever, Mahavan. Okay, it's not so far to Mahavan, but it's amazing. Even just a short walk from Satsang Bhavan to Mahavan, how much of a whole drama you can come up with, how much of a whole narration you can come up with about how evil this woman was, how selfish this woman was, how I will exact revenge on this woman, how I will deprive her whole family for generations to come of umbrellas. The anger, the rage, my Kshatriya tendencies were coming up. My Punjabi blood was boiling. And I got into the room, wet. And I opened my bag, which had also gotten wet. And inside my bag was my umbrella, which I had never even put there. I forgot to put it down because when I came into Satsang Bhavan, it wasn't raining, so it stayed in my bag. So why did I tell you three random stories? Let's reflect for a second. When we think about, in the first story, when we think about that fear, that student who had that such a deep, deep fear of bats, where was the fear located? I know that's a weird question. We don't usually ask, where is fear located? But where was the fear located? Was it located in the temple room? Was it located in the bat? Where was it located? Dhruv? In her mind. How do we know this? Because before she knew it was a bat, she was totally comfortable. It was swooping. Hi. So nice. She wanted to take selfies with the... But as soon as she knew, right, so in her mind. Second story. Once that, I'm going to use a slightly different word, that excitement, that enthusiasm, let's say that attachment. Once that attachment started forming for this idea of Shruti is going to be the soccer superstar that's going to vindicate my childhood trauma. Now we know that. But when that attachment was forming and getting stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger, where was it? Was it on the soccer field? Was it on the bench? She was on the bench. But is that where the attachment was? Am I attached to the girl that was sitting on the bench? Am I attached to the girl that was kicking the soccer ball, whose name I don't even know? Was I attached to the soccer ball, the goal? Where was the attachment actually forming? In my mind. How do we know this? Because as soon as I realized it wasn't Shruti, what happened to that attachment? What happened? Did I care about that? Umbrella story. That anger that was so strong that seemed like it was going to just engulf everything. It was going to change the course of my whole life's destiny. I was going to dedicate the rest of my life to defending the umbrella-less and to challenging the selfish umbrella stealers. of which I am one, I think, also. But where did that anger, where was that anger? That anger was also in my mind. So it's not a coincidence. I chose these three stories. In yoga philosophy, in the philosophy of the Gita, and this isn't, I believe, someone can share if it's more, but I believe in two shlokas in the Gita, maybe even more, Krishna uses this particular triad, this particular phrase, raga, bhaya, krodha. Raga means attachment. But we can also say it's attachment means excitement, desires. Right? When we create that story, that's raga. When we get super excited and pumped about something, that's in one sense raga. Bhaya is fear. And krodha is anger. And what does Krishna say about these three? He says, when we're not disturbed in mind, when our minds are stable, peaceful, controlled, as we'll talk about for the rest of our time, when that happens, we're not taken on this roller coaster ride. Some of us are like, how many of you like roller coasters? What's the appeal, Anirudh, of a roller coaster? Why do you like it so much? It's a very strange thing if you think about it. Everyone knows what a roller coaster is? Yeah? The ride that goes up and down and twists. You get to experience at least raga and bhaya, maybe not krodha, unless someone like throws up on you or something. But you get to express, you get to experience that intensity of raga and bhaya over and over again. And the more intense, the more extreme, the better. People who are into roller coasters, they're like, they chase the most extreme versions. It's like, this one is like the previous one, except you do it, the whole thing upside down, while standing, while suspended by your feet or something, right? There are some roller coasters you don't even get to sit down. Greater thrill. And then this one, it's even more thrill. The biggest thrill is going to a roller coaster in India. Because the safety seatbelt things that you're used to in America, in India, it's like the real thrill is like, it may or may not be there, we don't know. You don't know when this thing was made, you don't know who made it. But the reason we like those roller coasters is that thrill. But if our life is like a roller coaster, it's not a very fulfilling life to lead. And some of us have experienced, I'm not going to ask you to volunteer, but some of us have experienced in high school, in college, in the working world, in so many different settings, that roller coaster of emotions, that roller coaster of raga and bhaya and krodha. So if we don't want that roller coaster, we have to have a stable, controlled mind, and then we become free of the control, or the, we can say, we become free of being taken for a ride by this bhaya, this raga, this bhaya, and this krodha. And such a person who can do that, Krishna says in the second chapter, is called Astitadimuni, or a sage of steady mind. Good? Any questions? So from now until the rest of your life, control your mind. How do you do it? The way that you do it, and this is not just specific to our tradition is one which we'll talk about, that emphasizes, or you can say, that takes us to the deepest understanding of bhakti, that ultimately it's through bhakti. But we're also a yoga tradition. And all yoga traditions, whether it's more of karma yoga, jnana yoga, ashtanga yoga, all yoga traditions agree that the process of controlling the mind is the central feature. In fact, there's a great sage called Patanjali. And Patanjali defines yoga. Way before there was Lululemon, way before everyone wore yoga pants everywhere. In America, it's very strange. Everyone just wears yoga pants all the time, whether you do yoga or not. Just going to the supermarket, going to school, going anywhere, everyone wears yoga pants now. Before there was yoga pants, before there were yoga mats, before there was goat yoga. What a goat has to do with yoga, I still don't understand. But before there was all this stuff, Patanjali defined yoga. He defined yoga in a very simple way, in a sutra. Sutra means a very short aphorism. Does anyone know what is Patanjali's definition of yoga? You can just raise your hand and say if you know. Yoga's chitta vritti Nirodha. Chitta is another name for the mind. We're going to use manas, but chitta is another word that in yoga philosophy is used for the mind. Chitta vritti. What is a vritti? How does a roller coaster go? Those up and downs, they're called vrittis. So in your mind, you can pay, hundreds of dollars to go to theme parks, but none of the theme park roller coasters will compare to, at any given moment, the kinds of thrills and chills that you get in the vrittis of the chitta. So the chitta vritti, the ups and downs of the mind, the fluctuations, the flickering, the chatter of the mind, nirodha, still, stop. This is yoga. Yoga is that state, or we can say even that practice, of stilling the fluctuations, the up and down of the mind. That's all it is. And if we can do that, if we can practice, if we can work towards that, then so many other things become possible. And in our tradition, in our particular path that we're aspiring towards, we ultimately understand that as wonderful as it is to still the mind, to have a quiet mind, it's better to have a quiet mind than a noisy mind, right? Most of us think, I hope. In general, you don't want to get a headache. It's better to be in a quieter place than a noisy place, right? But the real joy comes when we quiet the mind, then we can actually tune in to the beautiful music that's playing. Because what does Krishna do all day, but especially at certain times? He plays the flute. How are you going to hear the flute, Vraja? You have ears that are designed, like mine, to hear the flute. But how are you going to hear it if it's too noisy? Imagine Krishna's playing his flute, but there's too much noise. You can't hear it. So we have to quiet get rid of the noise, make it quiet, so we can start hearing the flute that's playing. But it doesn't happen automatically. It takes some effort. It takes some intention. So for the rest of the time, what I'd like to do is I'd like to explore, practically speaking, how we can try to understand this idea of controlling the mind. Is that okay? You still with me? Okay. So I want to take us from the Bhagavatam, from the Gita, we're going to take a little side trip to another text called the Katha Upanishad. The Katha Upanishad is often considered very similar to the Gita. In fact, some of the shlokas are almost exactly the same. So it's very, very similar. It's a dialogue, but instead of a dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, it's a dialogue between a young boy, or sometimes said a teenager, so very appropriate for the Parivartan camp, named Nachiketa. And he's having a dialogue with the person who becomes his guru. Who is, does anyone want to guess? You can maybe see by the picture if you can. I know it's a little hard to make out. Yamaraj, the god of death. It's a long story in Katha Upanishad, but how Nachiketa goes to the abode of Yamaraj and he asks Yamaraj these questions and Yamaraj accepts him as a student. And the foremost question that he asks Yamaraj, which really, you can say, causes Yamaraj to accept him as a disciple. He says, I want to know the secret of death. I want to know how to overcome death. I want to know how one can actually experience eternal life. So Yamaraj was really pleased with this question, and he starts to teach him. And through the course of his teaching him, he teaches him in different ways, and so one of the ways he teaches him is through an analogy. It's a very famous analogy. It gets quoted a lot. Some of you may be familiar with it. It is the analogy of a chariot. So first, everyone can see the screen? Yes? I know the light makes it a little difficult, but please look at this image and follow along. And I want to ask you, it's a little confusing, I'm sorry, but I chose an image that's taken from an illustration of the Mahabharata, but just pretend that that's not Krishna and that's not Arjuna. So don't get confused, because this analogy of the chariot is just about chariots in general. It's not about Krishna and Arjuna. Okay? So Yamaraj gives the analogy of the chariot. And he explains like this. It's very interesting. Usually when, for those of us who are familiar with this Krishna Bhakti tradition, Krishna consciousness, ISKCON, all this stuff, usually we like to say that the ABCs of spiritual life is you are not this, you are not this, you are not this. Okay, that's true, but you have to put like a little like footnote. You are not this body, we are not these bodies, in the ultimate sense. But right now, we are embodied beings. In other words, we have bodies. So how do we understand? And we have other things too, which we're going to talk about. So there's lots of pieces that make up who we are. Ultimately, we are the soul or spirit soul. In Sanskrit, Atma. So that's true, ultimately. But in this conditioned life, we have these other pieces that we're working with also. So what's really nice is Yamaraj gives this analogy in such a way that it actually helps us to understand all of these different pieces and how they work together. So we're going to go through a little quickly. Unfortunately, we don't have that much time. We're going to go through a little quickly this analogy. So where should we start the analogy? Usually, we go from most gross to most subtle. I don't mean gross like, ew, that's gross. I mean gross like the most solid, concrete, perceptible by our senses, right, in this world, to the most subtle. So what is the first piece of the analogy that we want to start with? This analogy of the chariot. The horses. Even before the horses. The wheels. The charioteer. Okay, some different answers. The ground. Okay, we're not going to go quite that gross. Thank you. But you're on the right track. Okay. So the classical analogy is the chariot itself. Why? Because the chariot itself in our analogy represents the physical body. So we're not going to say too much about this. It's pretty self-explanatory. But why do you think someone can just... Why do you think the chariot, the body, rather, is compared to the chariot itself? Ananta. Yeah, so the Gita also reflects this idea that our material bodies are like vehicles, or like machines, like yantras. So why do you think this idea, you find this in other cultures also, but often they'll talk about the body, there come the rains, the body as a vehicle. So why does that make sense to you? Why would we compare the body to the vehicle? Anyone? Yeah, sure. Yeah. Does everyone hear that? It helps us do what we need to. It helps us get around. But we also have a sense, almost innately, we have a sense that we're someone inside looking out. Like when you're in a car, you have a sense, even though you really identify with that car, you like the way it feels when you're driving, you go from A to B, point A to point B, but you have a sense still that I'm a person sitting inside this car. So it kind of intuitively makes sense that the body is like a vehicle, right? Now, we're going to go more subtle. So if you have a chariot, or if you have a vehicle, if you have a golf cart that takes you because it's raining, you don't want to walk, so the golf cart takes you. So if you just have the vehicle, how far are you going to get? If you just have a car, but there's nothing else going on, it's just stationary, fixed. So how does a chariot actually get around? So now we go to the next part of the analogy. So Vraja. So some animal, you have to connect the chariot to some animal, and in this case, we're going to stick with, you could have it connected to other animals, but in the classical analogy, it's connected to horses. So the next part of our analogy is horses. So what do the horses represent for us? Remember, an analogy is point to point. And let me give you a hint. There are five horses. In this analogy, there are always five horses. Never three, never seven, there's always five. Oh, more hands are going up. Okay, Dhruv is the first hand I saw. The five senses. Why do you think the horses are compared to the senses? let's see if Mahabhav. Okay, good. You've given us a lot there. So let's unpack that. So the horses can either be controlled and then they go where we want them to go, or left to, say it again, Mahabhav, left to? Just repeat what you said. So if they're left uncontrolled, then they'll go anywhere where they want to. Right? So the whole thing with connecting the horses to the chariot is, if we can learn the art, then the horse's tendency to move helps the chariot to move where we want it to. If we don't, the chariot may still move, but it's going to move wherever the horses want it to move. So here's the $1 million or crore rupee question. Where do the horses go? Where will the horses go? Where do the horses want to go? Maybe that's not a great question, but yeah. Wherever there's food, what do horses like to eat? Sure. He grew up, he was born in New Vrindavan. I wasn't, so I'll defer to him. Apples and grass. That sounds wrong, but I'll take it. Apples and grass. So wherever there's apples and grass, that's where, naturally, default, the horses are going to go, towards the apples and grass. So in our analogy, we're not going to put it on the screen, but in our analogy, that apples and grass are like the objects of the senses. And if in their default position, in their natural position, in their, you can say, by instinct, where are the senses going to go? They're going to go to the sense object. If suddenly there's a loud noise, no matter how hard you're trying to pay attention, naturally your sense of hearing is going to go towards that loud noise. If a monkey comes in, jumps in, which I think there is a monkey around here, but if a monkey jumps, where are your eyes going to go? They're going to go towards the monkey, right? If there's a very fragrant aroma, your sense of smell, like that, all of our senses, if left to their own default position, they're just going to gravitate. They're going to be pulled. Have you ever had this experience of being pulled? Yeah? Raja answered very strongly. What's an example of where your senses were so pulled towards something? Almost you actually could, like a cartoon. Do you remember when you used to watch cartoons and someone would make like a pie or something and the smell of the pie, and it would pull the character, like Tom and Jerry or whoever, the character would get pulled, right? Have you ever had that experience? I know some of you have had that experience. Where? Across the street at Trinachi Cafe. Some fresh thing comes out. It's just hot out of the oven. The fragrance of that, I don't know if donuts give off a fragrance, or the fragrance of the donut, the freshly baked donut, or the vada pav, or whatever it is, and you're pulled. You know I should go to class. You know I have a session. You know I have Ishta Goshti. You know I have this, that. But you're pulled, 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 pulled. Where I live in Princeton, there are a few coffee shops, and there's one coffee shop in particular. And that coffee shop sells these vegan cookies. And I love these vegan cookies. They're these particular vegan cookies. Your sense of hearing is going towards the mind too. I love these vegan cookies. I love these vegan cookies. And when they bake them fresh in the morning, and I'm walking by that coffee shop, and the door of the coffee shop is open, I can tell you, I have been late for work. I know I'm late for work. I know I have a meeting. I know there's a student sitting outside of my office waiting. And I'm walking by, I'm walking very quickly down that street. And I blink. And when I open my eyes, I'm online to buy my cookies. I'm honestly telling you, it happens like that. I'm not even conscious of it. It becomes like a, what do they call it? Like a knee-jerk reaction. or like Pavlov's dog, where they, you know, they ring the bell and the dog starts salivating. They did an experiment like this. I've gone to get those cookies so much by smelling the cookies, the baking cookie smell, that now when I just smell the baking cookie smell, it pulls me in. So that's how powerful the senses are if left to their own devices. So what kind of chariot ride is that? It's like step into the golf cart and the golf cart's going to go wherever the cookies are. That's not going to work. That's not going to be a very good chariot ride. So what do we need to do? Mahabhav, nice and loud. What do we need to do? We need to control the horses. We need to control the senses. And so in this analogy, how does that happen? We're going more subtle now. It's getting more and more subtle. Through the ropes. What's another word for the ropes? The reins. So in our analogy, what do the reins represent? Not these reins. The reins that hold on to the rope. Premanand. Intelligence. That's a very intelligent answer. Unfortunately, sometimes intelligent answers can also be incorrect answers. You would think it's the intelligence. Someone else want to guess? The buddhi. You're giving me Google Translate of the same answer but in a different language. Also very nice, also very wrong. Yes, Prabhuji. The mind. You want to give the Sanskrit? Sanskrit. The manas. The reins are the manas. Now we're going to get to the intelligence and buddhi in just a second. Because there's a very important reason that the reins are the manas and not the buddhi. See, whoever came up with this analogy, Yamaraj, some rishi, muni, whoever came up with it, Krishna himself, it's a brilliant analogy. Subtle. The reins are the manas. Because the reins are directly connected to the horses. Similarly, the manas, the mind, is, like Prabhupada says in this purport, directly connected to the senses. One flows to the other. So let's go back to our cookie example. In our cookie example, I said I blinked and even though I should know better, even though I had no plan to, even though I've eaten enough cookies, my belly is proof of that, even though I don't have time to eat the cookies, all those things, I still ended up there. But I didn't mention there was one small step in between that was so subtle that I wasn't even maybe including it in the story, but we're going to include it. What was that small step? What happened between the moment I smelled the cookie and the moment I ended up inside that shop online? You're coughing. Okay. Yes. Sundarananda Prabhu, you're being very gracious by thinking that I made a decision. You're thinking very highly of me. The decision made me. I didn't make the decision. Right? When our senses are so strong, we're not making the decisions. The decisions are being made for us, and we're just going along. So it's not... So yes, I made a decision in a certain sense, but something much more gross happened. Ananta. I contemplated on it. Very sophisticated also. I contemplated. Perchance I should enjoy a cookie today. I know. You're going to... You're my Bhagavad Gita ride or die. But we're going to... Let's... Even more basic than that. What happens when you smell something really good? A little voice says, what? You get hungry. You know how I get hungry? A little voice inside of me says... How many of you have watched Sesame Street when you were young? You got Sesame Street in New Vrindavan? DVDs. Very good. Sesame Street, yes? On Sesame Street, there was a character. He loved cookies almost as much as I love cookies. He was called? Someone said Elmo. I'm deeply disappointed in you. Cookie Monster, it's in his name. The Cookie Monster. Wow, I'm spending way too much time on this. The Cookie Monster a voice inside of me, in the voice of the Cookie Monster from like when I was a kid, says,
Cookie!
I love you all so much that I'm willing to debase myself sitting on the Vyasasan doing this voice. They're never going to invite me back just to keep you awake. This voice inside says,
Me what? Cookie!
Because this is how our manas is. Our manas is not very sophisticated. Our manas is not making pros and cons list decisions. That comes a little bit later. Our manas is very, 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 very basic. Our manas says, I like this, I want this. I don't like this, get this away from me. When my manas smells cookies, my manas says, I want that. When my manas smells Shrikhand, which I don't like, or curry, which I really don't like, my mana says, get that away from me. Now, some of you don't like cookies, so your manas has the opposite story. No problem. All of our manas, our manases, manasai, I don't know how to pluralize that, our manas is individual based on our likes and dislikes. Our raga dvesha, our attachments and our aversions. So if you like the smell of cookie, your manas will say, cookie, we want that. If your manas likes the smell of curry, your manas will say, curry, I want that. But the point is, the manas just operates on this like binary of I want this, I don't want this, I like this, I hate this. And based on that, I ended up in the cookie shop. But if the manas was all that there was, right now you would all be eating vada pav, and I would be back in America eating cookies. I'll give you another example before we go on. When you were a real young kid, right? When Gitamrita was really young and she was sick and she needed to take medicine. Now, no matter how hard they try to make these children's medicines taste like cherry flavor and grape flavor and this flavor and that flavor, it always tastes horrible. It always tastes terrible. So when Gitamrita was really young, really, really small, and Ram Vijay Prabhu was trying to feed her that medicine so she would get better, what would he do? What would you do, Prabhu? So put it in different things, like try to hide it, disguise it. What if she just had to take the medicine and she tasted the medicine? What would she do? What would you do? Tell the truth. Cry, scream. Even before that, even when you were younger than that, you would cry, scream, but even more basically, first thing you would do is, you would spit it out. And so maybe Ram Vijay Prabhu had to kind of force it a little bit, or trick her or something, but somehow or other get it in there. Now Gitamrita is, how old are you? 13 years old. Now when you get sick and you taste that medicine and you put that spoonful of medicine in your mouth, what do you want to do? She said, I don't like the taste, but I'll still have it. When right now, if I were to take a spoonful of that medicine and feed it to Gitamrita right now, today, at the age of 13, sitting here in Govardhan Eco Village, you know what her manas would tell her to do? Her manas would tell her the exact same thing her manas told her when she was 4 years old. Yuck, spit this out. Because that's what their manas is, that's what its function is, that's what its job is. This tastes bad, spit it out. This tastes good, take it in. But today, 4-year-old Gitamrita would spit it out. 13-year-old Gitamrita doesn't spit it out. So what's changed? So thank you. So something has become strong enough in her now that she's able to answer back the manas that says, ew, this is gross, spit this out. There's another voice that's now stronger and more developed that says, no. Gita, what do you call yourself? Gita? No, Gita. Let's not spit this out. We need to have this medicine. Let's just tolerate it and swallow it. Question, comment? Yes, Dhruv. That is the intelligence. And where in our analogy is that? It's a ping pong match between the driver. Not Krishna, not Krishna, although related to Krishna, but not Krishna. In our analogy, in the classical analogy, the buddhi, we're going to use the Sanskrit, the buddhi, or what's sometimes translated as the intelligence, but I want to use slightly different language, because intelligence makes us think of reading lots of books, memorizing lots of things, doing really well in school, getting top grades. But this kind of intelligence, this is on a deeper level, this is what we might call the intelligence of wisdom. Or discernment. Discernment's a very old-fashioned English word, but it means the power to discriminate. That kind of intelligence, that's called buddhi. And we all have that in this chariot. That's, remember, this analogy is us. So the manas, going back to the cookies are there, that's like the apples and grass of the horse. My sense of smell smells the cookie, that's like the horses running towards there. My manas says, I want a cookie. Let's go eat cookie. Cookie, cookie, cookie. That's like the reins. Where do the reins go? The reins go wherever the horses go. Does anyone have a dog? Pet dog? You have a pet dog, Dhruv? What's your dog's name? Icy. Icy. He's a cool dog. He's Icy. So, Icy. So do you ever go take Icy for a walk? Do you put Icy on a leash? So when you have Icy on the leash, if you just put the leash on Icy and you say, okay, go for a walk, Icy, see you later, I have to study Gita verses, what is Icy going to do? Icy's going to run, he or she, he's going to run around. And where's the leash going to go? Wherever Icy goes. Trick question. So the manas is like that. The senses are going to go wherever they're going to go. The manas is also going to go wherever the senses are going to go. So we need someone to hold that leash. When you take Icy for a walk, sometimes Icy wants to run somewhere. Icy sees another dog or something, and Icy wants to go and attack that dog or play with that dog. So you know that's a little dangerous. So what are you going to do, Dhruv? What are you going to do? You're going to pull on the leash, and what happens to Icy then? Do you want to hurt Icy? So why do you pull on the leash? So Icy doesn't hurt himself. And then sometimes there's going to be a place for Icy to play, lots of room, you go to a park or something. And then what do you do with the leash? You leave it, you release it, or you loosen it at least. Okay, give Icy some room. So just like that, the buddhi is the person holding that leash or holding those reins. The buddhi knows. Not because the buddhi is cruel. Sometimes we have this idea that we always have to say no, no, no to the manas, to the mind. It's not like that. We're not here to beat up our minds. But we have to know, the buddhi knows, when is it healthy for the mind and when is it unhealthy for the mind? What is good for us and what is not good for us? What is good for our long term? The manas only thinks about short term. Cookie smells good, cookie tastes good, cookie now. This is the manas talks like, my manas talks like this. My buddhi is quite more sophisticated. My buddhi has like a slight British accent. Or like a Bombay Andheri accent. Very nice. My buddhi is much more refined. But my buddhi can tell my manas, you know, I know the cookie is good, but cookie is not good right now. If we're late for the meeting, we'll have more problems. So better we skip the cookie now, go to the meeting, and then maybe afterwards we can get a cookie, we can go for the cookie. Or my buddhi tells me, cookie is good, but you know, you've had cookie 3 times this week already. So maybe we skip cookies. Maybe we practice a little bit of discipline, right? Whatever it is, the buddhi is the one who is the dog walker. I don't want to say owner because that sounds harsh, but the master of the dog, the Prabhuji of the dog, right? There's so many dogs wandering around. Like Prabhupada gave this example, right? There's so many dogs wandering around, stray dogs. They don't have a master. But the dog that has a master is a dog that's cared for. So the buddhi is like that. Or in this analogy, getting back to the chariot, now the buddhi is like the driver that knows expertly how to control the reins, that knows when to loosen, when to tighten, how to get the horses to do what they're meant to do so the journey goes smoothly. Does that make sense? So when your manas says cookie, what does your buddhi say? Well, I already gave that example, right? When your alarm clock rings in the morning, or your roommate's alarm clock rings, which is more annoying than your alarm clock. It can be the same ringtone, but if when it's from your roommate's phone, it's extra annoying. This is a fact. So when your roommate's, one of the seven alarms that they've set, goes off at 3:30, 4 o'clock, whatever it is in the morning, and your manas says, go back to sleep. Your manas probably says a lot of things which you can't repeat in the temple room. But then your buddhi, and let's say you have to wake up, you have to go to, that day it's like mandatory, compulsory, Mangalarti. Your mana says, go back to sleep. And so you hit the snooze. And then it happens again. And you hit the snooze. Now the third time, hopefully your buddhi kicks in, and what does your buddhi say? Why? Remember yesterday we made a promise, we said we were going to go to Mangalarti? Remember how nice Mangalarti is? Remember how nice we feel when we go to Mangalarti? Remember how good, how connected to Krishna we feel? Remember how the deities looked? I know right now the bed seems like the most comfortable, wonderful place in the world. Tolerate a little bit of unhappiness now, and I promise you'll get so much happiness. Right? So our buddhis can have this dialogue with our manas. Make sense? This yoga process, to take it back, I know it feels like a long time ago we talked about yogic process, but the yogic process is basically the process of, as Prabhuji said, strengthening the buddhi and learning by practicing in small doses, just like we practice yoga in small doses, we're disciplining and training the body, the mind. So quieting, stilling, calming down, learning to control the manas through practice, and learning to strengthen the buddhi. So that each time the voice of the manas becomes a little less controlling, it'll still be there, but the buddhi becomes stronger and stronger. That is yoga. That is a yoga process. In bhakti, we have this added dimension that ultimately we try to align the buddhi with Paramatma, with Krishna. So that with time, the voice of that buddhi can be in alignment or practically synonymous with the voice of the guidance of Paramatma. Paramatma guides the buddhi guides the manas. So there's one more part of the analogy. It's actually not Paramatma in the classical analogy. There's one more part of the analogy. So what is the last part of the analogy? Let's see, someone we haven't heard from. Guess, it's okay. Shrishta, you look like you're on the cusp of the answer. What's the last part of the analogy? Yeah. The person who's sitting, and who is that? The soul. Or the Atman. The Atma is that passenger. Why passenger? You would think maybe, especially those of us coming from the West, you would think that Atma should be the one, the driver, most important. The Atma's kind of boring, sitting passenger in the back. Why? What do you think? Did everyone hear that? The passenger, just to paraphrase, is in one sense not beholden to the chariot. So if it's more helpful, because most of us don't go on chariot rides, think about an Uber. How many of you have used an Uber at least once in your life? Or Ola or Lyft or any other company. Think about that. When you call an Uber ride, you sit in the Uber, you go on the ride, someone else is driving, but whose ride is that? It's your ride. You're going to your destination. So who's the most important person in that equation? As important as the driver is, as important as the car is, as important as the engine is, as important as all those pieces of the analogy are, there is no journey without the passenger. So also, the passenger is the Atma. Now, let's say a vehicle were to pull right up to the temple and Radhanath Maharaj is sitting in the vehicle. Chances are, although Maharaj will surprise you, who knows, but chances are Maharaj will be the passenger. He'll be sitting in the back of that vehicle. So the vehicle will pull up and Maharaj will be sitting there. And we will say, conventionally, most of us will not say, "Hey everyone, look, there's a golf cart. Inside the golf cart has an engine or a battery. Inside the golf cart, there's a driver. The driver is holding a steering wheel. And finally, at the end, if you've stayed with me this long, Radhanath Maharaj is sitting there." We don't usually talk like that. What will we say? "Hey, Radhanath Maharaj just pulled up. Radhanath Maharaj is here. Maharaj is here. Maharaj is here." It's true. Because we recognize that the most important piece to this puzzle when that vehicle pulls up is that passenger. So the most important, essential component of who we are and the ultimate, essential, true self who we are is the Atma that's seated there. But all these pieces do their part. When the system is working properly, then what happens? The horses are guided nicely through the power of the reins. The charioteer or the driver is expertly controlling those reins. And the driver is doing that on behalf of the passenger, on behalf of the, as the Katha Upanishad says, the lord of the chariot, the VIP. And so everything goes smoothly. But what happens when, let's say, we just let things, let's be just be natural. Don't worry so much about all this stuff. Let's just let everyone do whatever they want to do. What happens? Where do the horses go, Mahabhav? Wherever they want. Where do the reins go? With the horses. What is the charioteer doing? He's asleep or he's drunk or something. Have you ever been, maybe I shouldn't ask, but anyway, we have an experience once last year being in India with a driver that was intoxicated. It is one of the most, and you find out later only, I didn't willingly, but I found out later, hey, something's wrong with the way he's driving. And this was in a place called Mussoorie. How many of you have been to Mussoorie? Mussoorie, it's like in the mountains. So we're driving up and down these mountainous roads, and like this guy is on something. It's one of the most terrifying experiences. So the whole system falls apart. And who is ultimately going to suffer the most? Everyone suffers, but who's going to ultimately suffer the most? The passenger. So the whole yoga process is to correct this, what has become, unfortunately, what has become our default position in the material world. It's a long story. We don't have time for that. I was told I could go till 9:15, so I'm milking that for everything it's worth. It's a story for another class. But we have been conditioned since seemingly time immemorial in this unhealthy pattern where our default has now become the horse runs wherever the heck it wants to run, the rein is flopping behind, the driver is drunk, the chariot is like kind of busted up. Either we take too much care of the chariot and we invest all our energy in the chariot, or we neglect the chariot and the chariot falls apart. So nothing is healthy in this system. And then we wonder, why is my life so... Why am I experiencing so much drama? Why am I experiencing so much raga, bhaya, krodha? So by this yogic process, we can start to realign and bring these things into proper alignment. So I have, anyway, there's not much time, but afterwards we can talk, I can share this presentation with you. But there's Gita verses that go with all of this, that what happens with the default paradigm? The senses control the mind. The mind gets dragged wherever the senses go. The mind bullies the buddhi. So now the buddhi that was supposed to control the manas. You ever see like a little guy in Andheri walking like a big dog? And it's like the dog is walking the walker, right? So that, not you and I see. I'm saying someone else, your neighbor. So like this, the manas becomes like the one who's in charge of the buddhi, and the buddhi starts to get controlled by the manas. So it's, everything is absolutely reversed. And now this buddhi, because it has to still do something, now the buddhi starts using intelligence to justify whatever the manas wants. Ultimately building up the ego and the atma, what to speak of connection to Krishna, Paramatma, all of that gets forgotten. Even with good intention, even we're trying to practice Krishna consciousness, we're trying to be Krishna conscious, in the moment, we get swept away, swept away, swept away. But in the bhakti paradigm, if we can reverse this, if we can have the senses function as tools to navigate the world, we need to engage the senses. The senses are important. They're not bad. We just need to channel them properly, engage them properly. How? By the manas directing them. Krishna gives the example of a tortoise. The tortoise knows how to extend its limbs out, but then have you ever seen a turtle or a tortoise? It goes within. So we need to practice. We need to know when to engage out and when to withdraw, come inside. That the manas can do. And that's done when the buddhi properly guides the manas and it helps it to see the bigger picture, to rise above short-term attachments and aversions. And Krishna says this is like a lamp in a windless place, steady, stable. That strengthened buddhi helps us to distinguish between the ego and our actual identity, the actual atma, and helps us to reconnect with Paramatma or Krishna. And that through that experience, we can have a very aligned, harmonious journey. Ultimately, the journey back home, back to Godhead, towards Krishna. So I know that was a quick run-through, but does anyone have any questions, comments, thoughts, reflections that they want to share? No? Yes, Prabhu.
You know, thank you for deep analysis of you know, our inner world, you know, with the chariot example. So that was beautiful. One point that stuck out with me was how, you know, as I mean, you were mentioning this point that especially happiness in the mode of goodness is, you know, it starts with a little bit of, I mean, Krishna says poison or inconvenience, and then ends up, you know, as nectar. So that stood out to me, and I mean, of course, I've been, you know, hearing that verses for a long time, but it was striking because that's what we, you know, naturally, or the mind actually, you know, repulsive towards is that inconvenience. But once you overcome that inconvenience, but accept that inconvenience voluntarily, then, you know, there is the greater nectar that's waiting for us at the end of that exercise. So thank you for bringing that point.
Thank you. Thank you for that reflection. Yeah, if we can key in, the stronger the buddhi is, the more we can recognize this principle that Krishna says in the Gita, right? That real lasting happiness, sustainable happiness, sattvic happiness, happiness in sattva, it's almost always like that. That there's some, in the short term, there's some inconvenience, there's some sacrifice, there's some even pain, right? No pain, no gain. If you're doing panchakarma treatment, there's some purification. But the buddhi helps us to remember, right? So to the extent that the buddhi is strong, to the extent we'll be able to do that. And just being aware of that, I want to say, practically speaking, I know it's difficult, but if you're just aware that just like there's a manas that's screaming at you, I want that cookie, or I want to, you know, sleep in, or whatever the manas is saying. And by the way, the buddhi doesn't always have to disagree with the manas. It's not that, but the buddhi sees the bigger picture. So just reminding yourself that there is a buddhi within me that can just take a beat, take a moment, and guide the manas. Any other questions, comments? Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna Madhunatha. Thank you so much, Prabhu. You had a wonderful PPT. But just one question which I find sometimes difficult to justify is that how to decide whether it's a mind or intelligence. Because sometimes I just feel that, oh, this is the needed part and the fear of losing it. So I think that it is the intelligence which is talking me to it. And sometimes it says, no, it's the mind and I should give it up, or rather say, it all about the relations, if not the temptations part, but about something like reacting to a person or something like that. So what should be the real thing which we should follow for it? Whether to discriminate between the mind and intelligence?
Such a great question. What do we think? Does anyone have some thoughts on this? How do we distinguish between that voice of the manas and the voice of the buddhi? Ananta and Dhruva. Wait for the microphone.
So I've heard from some other speakers that the voice of the mind is very loud, like it's screaming at you, and it's persistent, like it nags you constantly all the time, and if you try to stop it, it'll get louder and scream more. And I've heard that the voice of the intelligence, or when it's aligned, the voice of the Paramatma who's speaking, it's soft, it only comes once, it won't persist, whatever.
So some indication, right? Volume, persistence. Dhruv?
So I think one way to distinguish is when you think of the mind, it's actually the thoughts are really impulsive, right? So you can make that out. Thoughts are really impulsive, so you know it's a mind. But when it's the buddhi speaking, it takes into account the bigger picture, and it thinks about it. It really puts an effort into thinking about the outcomes of what you're trying to do or what is happening. So I think that's one way to distinguish.
Yeah. Nice answers. Yeah, I would echo that. I mean, it's difficult, and that's why we have practices, right? The more we're doing our practices, and even meditation, different forms of meditation. Of course, for us primarily, it's japa. But there are also, there's benefit to doing other kinds of meditation, even silent meditation, to just learn to quiet down, and that'll help us to distinguish. But we can start to tell the difference. Okay, there's a difference in tone, there's a difference in persistence, there's a difference in the impulsive nature. The manas tends to be reactive, whereas the buddhi tends to be responsive. You've heard the difference between these two, right? The manas tends to be much more reactionary. It's reaction. And a key giveaway for the manas also is if you can most generally, you can quickly connect manas to either an attachment or an aversion. Right? If you find, you hear a voice, an internal voice, and it's very clearly connected to an attachment or an aversion, chances are it's heavily manas, manasic voice. There's a little bit less, if there's more of a detachment, if there's more of a perspective, chances are it's buddhi. So if it's okay, let's close there. I know I'm keeping everyone from prasad, and there's some strict timings with breakfast. So thank you all for indulging me. I know it's a long class. Hopefully you've gotten some takeaways. I want to encourage you to just reflect on this and decide for yourself what you want to take away and implement in your own lives. Okay. Thank you so much. Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Shaprabhupada ki.